Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on evolving immunotherapy strategies for stage 1 to 3 non-small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Tina Cascone, Puneeth Iyengar, and Paula Ugalde-Figueroa will discuss the multidisciplinary management of resectable and unresectable disease, spanning surgical workup and resectability, perioperative immunotherapy trial data, and the integration of radiation with immunotherapy. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals. In the first segment, Dr. Ugalde reviews staging workup and how immunotherapy is redefining resectability.
Number one, please don't forget, perform complete workup before considering any treatment allocation is non-negotiable. Number two, the resectability, we talk about that all the time in tumor board. This decision is not unilateral, shouldn't be of the medical oncologist or the surgeon. It should be a decision from the team. And this has been shown in multiple studies, including this recently published study from the EORTC. And lastly, surgery is essential in this setting, in this moment that we're living with the neoadjuvant chemo IO. However, it requires a dynamic evaluation. After neoadjuvant therapy, we should reassess resectability. So let's get started. According to the NCCN guidelines, every patient with a non-small cell lung cancer, clinical stage 1, 2, 3, should start the investigation with radiologic imaging, chest CT scan. Personally, for the surgeons, with contrast is really important to help us assess resectability. PET scan will rule out distant metastasis and will also assess the mediastinum, and the brain MRI will assess brain mets. What we should never do is use the PET scan as the sole instrument to stage the patient. In this era, it is mandatory that we perform invasive mediastinal staging, ideally with EBUS, which is less invasive. But if you don't have EBUS, mediastinoscope will do just as good. Start sampling the contralateral lymph nodes to rule out N3 disease. Those are considered unresectable by guidelines. And then continue staging patients in stages in stations N2 and N1. Please do not forget to assess stations N1, those qualified for neoadjuvant strategy in this with this protocol of neoadjuvant chemo IO. When do we escalate? When EBUS is either inconsistent or non-diagnostic in a PET-positive mediastinum, you should perform mediastinoscopy or VATS. If you look at the most recent versions of the NCCN, you will see that now patients with clinical stage 1B through 3B should undergo evaluation for perioperative treatment and should all undergo biomarker testing. This is a huge change in the NCCN guidelines. If you follow the guidelines, 2 years ago, we didn't have this set this way. And now the two first bullet points are perioperative consideration of systemic therapy and biomarker testing. For the T4 tumors, the NCCN does not recommend neoadjuvant therapy if the patient has mediastinal lymphadenopathy, only if it has hilar lymphadenopathy. For us surgeons, it is key to ensure that the patient is fit for the procedure that he is allocated. We do regularly pulmonary function and cardiac evaluation. We, in our institution, perform exercise tolerance routinely also in all patients. Patients with a performance status 0 or 1 are considered candidates for surgery. Patients with a status 2, those are more selectively included in a strategy with surgery. So this is the workup synthesis. We should have all the imaging tests, the invasive staging of the mediastinum, the biomarker testing, and the fitness assessment. With those four inputs, those four pillars, we have all the information necessary to assess if the patient is resectable and a good candidate for a surgical strategy in this neoadjuvant era. The multidisciplinary care is key to decide who should be allocated for surgery. And in this table, or at the table, we should have the surgeon, we should have the medical oncologist, and we should have the radiation oncologist. If you work in an integrated cancer center, your patient should see the three of you, and the three of you should discuss the management of the patient. Each member of the tumor board will bring on their expertise. I have to say that the resectability, however, though I will tell the technical details of the procedure by itself, but resectability also includes the prognosis of the disease, and that requires medical oncology and radiation oncology. Also, it's key that your tumor board has, your institution has the infrastructure to offer patients multidisciplinary care. And that includes two important pillars. One is the communication. I mean, we're flooded with emails and messages and meetings to discuss what should be done with the patient, but also you should have support from your institution to offer the best care and more modern care to the patients. For me, as a surgeon, it is key, as I mentioned before, to know exactly if that case is resectable or not. According to the ISLC, resectable lung cancer is the one that I can predict that I can offer a complete resection, which includes negative margins, complete removal of the tumor with no positive margins, no signs that I left tumor behind, and I did a high-quality lymph node dissection. But in this era, this is a very dynamic concept, and we should reassess resectability after induction. So, resectability is a clinical judgment. That means that my clinical judgment might be different from another surgeon that has a different setting in his hospital. Residual tumor classification, which is the R0, there's a lot of confusion here. Residual tumor classification is assigned after the surgical resection. So only after I remove the tumor is that we will know the R classification, which can be R0, 1, 2, or unknown, or uncertain, sorry. So these are two completely different definitions that interact. So why in this era, this subject of resectability became a hot topic? Well, immunotherapy has expanded the role of surgery in locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and it's challenging the criteria by which surgical candidacy is determined. You know, not so long ago, many patients with clinical stage 3 and 2 disease were not even selected candidates for surgery. But now in this immunotherapy era, we're seeing major pathologic responses and meaningful nodal downstaging, including in patients with multiple N2 disease, which has really turned the scenario around and made this a more exciting moment for surgery in this setting. However, for the surgeon, the practical consequence is not simply that more patients can undergo surgery, but we should be responsible and know how to select them properly. Societies have been trying for very long to come up with a definition of resectability. We really don't have one, but this is a recent published paper from the EORTC in which they propose that tumors with clinical stage 3 are classified into resectable, potentially resectable, and unresectable according to a pool of specialists. This is the most recent publication that we have on the matter, and it's a recommendation for future trials. This should not be taken for tumor board decisions, this is not what this work was meant for. So, as I mentioned before, immunotherapy is changing resectability, and we surgeons must reassess it and not simply assume it. Surgeons have to engage early in the multidisciplinary management. We need to reassess resectability after systemic therapy to identify patients who truly benefit from surgery. And that's why surgery remains essential in this era.
In the next segment, Dr. Cascone reviews the rationale for perioperative immunotherapy and the key adjuvant and perioperative trial data in resectable NSCLC.
I think as a natural flow, me as a medical oncologist will give you some updates in the neoadjuvant, adjuvant, and perioperative immune-based therapy setting for these patients. And really, I want to challenge how we tailor this wealth of data on our patients in the context of a multidisciplinary discussion. Here you have my disclosure. I want to start off with the science, because the science is really what has driven the incredible change that we have seen over the past 10 years, really, probably even less, for patients with resectable non-small cell lung cancer. So why is it important to deliver immunotherapy, perhaps, in the perioperative setting, and why specifically pre-surgery or post-surgery, or together pre- and post-surgery? Because when we have a tumor and lymph nodes in place, we have an intact tumor immune microenvironment. We have perhaps lower clonality that has not undergone changes with prior systemic therapy. And we can perhaps trigger the release of antigen and trigger immunological memory. We can also kill micrometastatic disease very early on, right, in the biological clock of the disease. And when we actually think about delivering this therapy, immunotherapy, after surgery, we can definitely restore an immunosuppressed microenvironment that has been triggered by surgery, but we have a limited release of antigens because the tumor and the lymph nodes have been already removed. From a clinical standpoint, administering in neoadjuvant immune checkpoint inhibition can give us different and a variety of advantages. First of all, especially in the context of chemotherapy, we can hopefully, as Dr. Galde mentioned to you, achieve that maximal pathological shrinkage and reduction. Very importantly, we can use surrogate endpoints of hard efficacy, so MPR, major pathological response, PCR, pathological complete response, to evaluate the activity of a drug in a very much of expedited fashion. And we can do translational analysis with pre- and post-therapy samples to really advance science and design better next-generation trials. In the adjuvant setting, as I mentioned, you can definitely restore that immunosuppressive environment that has been induced by surgery. And in the perioperative setting, you can actually take the advantages of both approaches and continue to stimulate that immunological memory throughout the surgical setting. What about adjuvant immunotherapy? We have the IMpower010, which has led to the approval of the atezolizumab after platinum-based chemotherapy and surgery for patients with PD-L1 positive disease, 1% under FDA, 50% and higher under the EMA. You see here the long-term, more than 60% months follow-up. You can see still a very nice separation of the curves as far as DFS, a trend toward an improvement in OS, but this has not quite reached statistical significance. The KEYNOTE-091 of PEARLS with pembrolizumab given in the adjuvant setting after surgery and platinum-based chemotherapy for patients with resected disease. You can see here the four-year rates in favor of pembrolizumab. This is all comers in the IA3 analysis. So this is the plan interim analysis and the last one, number three. And then you see the BR31 just recently published, where you can actually see an overlapping of the curve. So not only benefit from adjuvant durvalumab, but we can speculate on why and how. Definitely different population of patients, heterogeneous population of patients, different surgery techniques, different mandated surgical outcomes. So something important to keep in mind. Something I wanted to mention, this is brand new data from World Lung last year. The NADIM adjuvant, this is a very important phase 3 randomized trial led by the Lung Cancer Spanish Group, where in patients with resected non-small cell lung cancer, we're now testing an approach of adjuvant combined chemo immunotherapy for up to 4 cycles, followed by a maintenance nivolumab for 6 months, compared to the standard of care at that time when the trial was launched, chemotherapy followed by observation. You can see a separation of the curves. This is a very initial DFS analysis with a 57% of maturity of data. There's an initial crossing of the curves. This is very important to consider. So why there is an initial signal in favor of adjuvant combined chemoimmunotherapy followed by maintenance, it's important to keep in mind that we need to see prolonged follow-up and more mature data. This is data that you will see presented at this ASCO meeting by Dr. Jimmy Shaft, the Alchemist Nivolumab trial. This is a trial that has taken exactly 10 years to mature. And so hopefully this also highlights how important it is to perhaps have an early readout of efficacy with MPR and PCR with neoadjuvant treatment as compared to DFS outcome after surgery as done when we test agents in the adjuvant setting. So key findings with nivolumab given in the adjuvant setting after surgery and chemotherapy, median follow-up, 73 months almost. No improvement. Took 73 months to learn that there is no DFS improvement with adjuvant nivolumab. You can see the numbers here, median DFS, about 72 months versus 69 months with an hazard ratio that almost reaches 1. Aegean, perioperative setting. This was the very first reported trial, up to 4 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy plus durvalumab, followed by surgery and 1 year of durvalumab, as compared to up to 4 cycles of chemo plus placebo, followed by placebo. This is one of the largest trials that we have in the perioperative setting, more than 800 patients. PCR and EFS as co-primary endpoint. An initial EFS and ALK inclusion up to about 50 patients, and then the trial excluded all the EGFR and ALK-driven tumors. Here you have the latest data presented in 2024, EFS and DFS with benefit in favor of perioperative durvalumab. We're waiting for more maturity of the data and additional follow-up. And then you can see here again, the lung cancer specific survival favoring perioperative durvalumab and the interim analysis planned for OS with a non-trivial amount of censoring in these curves on the right, but definitely an initial separation of the curves, perhaps lending support in favor of perioperative durvalumab. KEYNOTE-671, again, one of the largest perioperative trial that was the only perioperative trial with immunotherapy that had overall survival as a co-primary outcome. Again, up to 4 cycles of neoadjuvant pembrolizumab plus platinum-based chemotherapy, cisplatin only allowed in this trial. No carboplatin allowed in the KEYNOTE-671, followed by surgery and up to 13 cycles of pembrolizumab. EGFR and ALK not excluded, with a very minimal amount of patients, approximately 14, 15 patients in each group. Here you have the very latest data, the 5-year EFS updates presented at ESMO last year by Dr. Wickley. There is a meaningful separation of these curves. This is undeniable. We have a 5 years, 50% of patients with no events as compared to 26.5% in favor of perioperative pembro with benefit pretty much seen across all the key clinical subgroups. I want to point out your latest subgroups, the last one, less than 1%, perhaps less magnitude of benefit, but still an hazard ratio of 0.74. And that's why, at least for this specific drug, FDA, EMA, no restriction based on PD-L1. If you have a PD-L1 negative patient, you do still provide benefit by giving perioperative immunotherapy. Overall survival outcomes, again, a lot of censoring, so we're looking forward to see even further maturity, but it's undeniable. Again, 65% versus 53% of patients alive with this regimen. What about if we dissect the population of patients, the PCR versus non-PCR? This is important as we think about, is it meaningful to administer that additional phase of adjuvant treatment after we have done 3-4 cycles of adjuvant chemo. So I dissected the data here for you. Checkmate 816. Of course, all these trials are going to have different length of follow-up. So bear with me on the different length for your x-axis. But you can see that, again, for patients with PCR, you have a better prognosis regardless of the arm you're in. But it appears to me that even in patients with PCR, there is a benefit in administering the immunotherapy regimen, whether you do it in the CheckMate 816 with neoadjuvant only. And then you can see in the pembrolizumab, this is brand new data from the ELCC, you do still have a separation of the curves with the perioperative approach in the PCR population. Whether this is an effect of the neoadjuvant treatment carrying on, or there is an isolated added benefit of the adjuvant, we will not know from these trials. And that's the same for the tislelizumab from the RATIONALE 315 that, again, was just presented in dissected fashion, PCR, non-PCR, in the ELCC. Here you have the KEYNOTE-671 data for the non-PCR population. So perhaps as expected in patients that do not have 0% residual viable tumor surgery, where you do not have an escalation strategies, perhaps would make sense in absence of other treatments to continue pembrolizumab based on this data. And the same, although we have less, as I mentioned, maturity of follow-up, applies for the Aegean. You can see on the farther right some degree of benefit for perioperative durvalumab in patients without a PCR, as well as in patients with PCR. CheckMate 77T, very similar paradigm, up to 4 cycles of neoadjuvant platinum-based chemotherapy, carbo or cis allowed with nivolumab, followed by surgery, and then 1 year of nivolumab as compared to chemotherapy plus placebo. EFS as primary endpoint, blinded independent central review, no EGFR ALK allowed. This is the latest updated EFS by Bicor, 0.61 as a ratio. So we're continuing to see benefit over time with the perioperative approach. The plan interim analysis, number one, a lot of censoring on the left, but some hint of perhaps benefit in favor of perioperative nivo. And again, as expected, benefit for perioperative nivo as far as the lung cancer specific survival. In the CheckMate 77T perioperative nivo, again, you do very well if you achieve a PCR. You can see the separation of the curves from surgery. Okay, this is a landmark EFS from surgery to try to tease out the benefit of that adjuvant component in a very exploratory fashion, because we still cannot neglect that the benefit might be carried on from the neoadjuvant phase. But you see in the non-PCR patients, still benefit with the perioperative approach. So EFS favor perioperative nivo in both the PCR and non-PCR, although, of course, as expected, who achieves a PCR perhaps has the best outcomes as we know it so far.
In the final segment, Dr. Iyengar discusses integrating radiation with immunotherapy for unresectable stage 3 disease.
The focus of my presentation today is to talk about unresectable stage 1-3 non-small cell lung cancer and how radiation is being integrated with immunotherapy to optimize our outcomes for this population of patients. So how to integrate radiotherapy in an era that's rapidly changing? And again, you know, the emphasis has to be on multimodality therapy. And I think one can make the argument, that this day and age, for every stage of lung cancer, there may be a role for every modality of treatment, whether it's early stage disease, locally advanced disease, or even advanced disease in the setting of oligometastatic disease. There is a role for local therapy and systemic therapy. But in the form of radiation, it's sequencing and timing of IO and radiation that I think is going to be critically important. Dr. Cascona alluded to really wanting to understand the biology of what's happening to the tumor microenvironments, what's happening to control of micrometastatic disease, local, regionally, and distantly, and then what's happening to tumor intrinsic biology. And the same thing applies for radiation. The one caveat that I would say about radiation and the studies that incorporate radiation is we don't have the benefit of what Dr. Cascone was pointing out, Dr. Guadalupe-Figueroa was pointing out with respect to preoperative studies. These types of preoperative platform trials where you have a systemic therapy and then you get a surgical specimen, so you really get a better understanding of the biology. In the setting of radiation trials and radiation paradigms, you don't get that tissue again. So after some type of systemic therapy approach or after a systemic therapy approach after. So we really have to start thinking about radiomics and those types of approaches to optimize our ability to predict and prognosticate outcomes for our patients. So, of course, variation may be dependent on the heterogeneity of disease. As a radiation oncologist, I don't necessarily, you know, for stage three disease, think about STK11 mutated tumor or STK11 keep co-occurring mutation. I don't necessarily think about copy numbers, genetics, but because unfortunately at this stage, we're using a one-size-fits-all approach for the treatment of stage three disease, but that needs to evolve as well. And so that's what I talk about when I say molecular considerations may impact response, especially in terms of durable responses. And we really need to focus on clinical trials to tease these out. And so why is it, you know, a really fundamental biologically interesting question to think about immunotherapy and radiation combinations? It's because intrinsic radiation can do a lot of things. It can improve antigen presentation. It can augment dendritic cell maturation, and it certainly reduces large tumor masses. And so this is the type of biology that's relevant to converting a cold to a hot tumor or making some tumors perhaps more susceptible to immunotherapy benefits. But there are certainly, and modifiable factors could include the PD-1s, could include ADCs, bispecifics, what have you. But the other thing that radiation can also do in a detrimental way is that it can affect CD4 helper cells. It can unfortunately upset the balance of Tregs. And so, you know, the things that we were talking about before with respect to understanding how much radiation we need to offer, is it always 60 gray and 30 fractions for stage three patients? When is the timing with respect to chemotherapy, and when is, you know, the dealing with steroid use in the setting of radiation and pneumonitis? These are all things that we have to think about when balancing the radiation benefits versus the suppressive effects and when combining with immunotherapy. So let's just now start talking about some of the trials that are evolving. We are much further behind, as I would say, again, with respect to the speed at which this surgical studies are being moved forward. But, you know, we have to do this in a very methodical fashion. So, of course, we all know about the PACIFIC study, which really established a standard of care out to a very significant benefits out to 5 years and beyond, and continues to show separation of the curves. And so, you know, this is the obvious standard of care for patients with stage three unresectable non-small cell lung cancer. Now, you know, it would be remiss of us not to continue to collect data on patients that are being treated with the PACIFIC regimen in order to optimize our understanding of whether disease heterogeneity plays a role in optimizing and in regulating tumor outcomes. So this was, I think, an amazing study, the PACIFIC, the real world study that was initiated in order to really get an understanding of what is happening with real world data. It was almost more or less a observational registry study. And then there would be a retrospective evaluation, and several of us have taken part in this study. But, you know, the bottom line is the real world data did mimic the findings from the randomized study. And more importantly, it did suggest, you know, some potential increased information with respect to PD-L1 status, you know, being perhaps in a beneficial higher PD-L1 expression. So many of you were, you know, right with that, you know, thought. But, you know, as what Dr. Cascone said, we probably need to continue to look at these things as a continuous variable. Why is it, you know, we do it less than 1%, 1 to 49%, 50% or higher, you know, And our group, Adam Schoenfeld at MSK, has actually, you know, started to look and has been looking at actual PD-L1 expression to try to see if specific cut points can give us a better sense of which patients will have a more durable outcome versus a less durable outcome. And I think those are the types of quantitative approaches we need to take for all of our studies in order to optimize and personalize care towards single patients. But the real world study overall was highly informative and gave us a sense that the approach was absolutely appropriate for a larger spectrum of patients with unresectable stage 3 disease. So then I guess you could say we started to get greedy. We said, you know what? We've shown a significant benefit of adjuvant IO, durvalumab, with respect to progression-free survival, with respect to overall survival. Can we bring this further up in the treatment paradigm to see if there are benefits? And so the PACIFIC 2 study, which was led by my colleague and good friend, Dr. Bradley, basically took stage 3 patients. But unlike PACIFIC, where the randomization was after the chemo radiation, here the randomization was upfront. So patients with stage 3 unresectable disease were randomized to chemo radiation plus IO versus chemo radiation plus placebo. And then patients were either received durvalumab until progression or placebo until progression. And unfortunately, we did not see a significant benefit with respect to overall survival or progression-free survival on this study. I think in retrospect, this is not very surprising because our head and neck colleagues did the same thing with their patient populations that had locally advanced disease, tried to incorporate immunotherapy concurrently with chemo radiation. And those studies also did not show a benefit with respect to progression-free survival or overall survival. Now, there have been multiple studies that have looked at this concurrent approach, which we'll get to in a second, that have not shown a benefit. So, one could make the argument that our preclinical data that supported these approaches may have not been as robust as we would have liked. Clearly, there's something that's happening with respect to the immunotherapy that's given concurrently. It could be that the radiation that's been given at the same time is ruining the signaling and the pathways that it would be relevant for immunotherapy benefit if it's given concurrently. Whereas in an adjuvant setting, the radiation is done. You don't keep receiving an insult, which could be affecting the activation of the immune cells that are necessary to support PD-1 or PD-L1 types of benefits. And so, unfortunately, a negative study, but certainly revealing. So let's take a look at another study that is following in suit from the a few other studies that have not necessarily followed the concurrent chemo radiation immunotherapy paradigm, but are ones that Dr. Casconi pointed out before. And one is the induction approach. So now we're starting to think like surgeons. So this is the PACIFIC Brazil study, treatment naive stage 3 patients. They get 2 cycles of induction chemo IO. And then unfortunately, they also get IO with concurrent with chemotherapy because the chemo radiation, because, you know, one could anticipate that as you start moving further out from these types of treatments, if you're using an induction approach, you may promote resistance mechanisms if you stop abruptly giving the drug. So that was, I think, part of the scientific rationale for why they continued that concurrent chemo radiation with the IO. And then they again gave immunotherapy. So it was 3 components: induction, concurrently, and adjuvantly. Would we say that's overkill? Perhaps from some of our surgical experiences. But nonetheless, single arm study, the 1-year PFS was 68%. So this needs to be played out in randomized studies to see if there's a significant benefit. The other study that Dr. Casconi mentioned, the Apollo study, again, induction chemo IO followed by chemo radiotherapy and IO maintenance in stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer. And so this study also gave us some really good signals about progression-free survival, overall survival, and Pacific-related PFS outcomes. So these studies that are now moving the immunotherapy not just concurrently, but as an induction regimen, I think could play a very pivotal role. So unfortunately, there were a few more studies that tried to incorporate immunotherapy with chemo radiation that did not meet their endpoints, such as these trials. I mean, a lot of effort, a lot of patients put on the study, but I guess the real lesson learned is about the concurrent approach not being the appropriate one for this patient population. And Salma Jabor, one of my great friends, is still like kind of leading this study with the key link with the pembrolizumab given concurrently with chemo radiotherapy. You know, each of these IOs, we all say they are all behave the same. Maybe there is some differences, but you know, we'll see how this reads out. So I just wanted to give a plug for this idea that exactly what Dr. Cascone is saying, that local failures or intrathoracic failures of original sites of gross disease are the, you know, are the main sites or risks for recurrence. So this study tries to take advantage of LU008, where basically we are taking the primary disease, if it's isolated in the parenchyma, and using SBRT doses to get to a higher biologically effective dose to kill off the tumor, get a better local control, still using standard fractionation radiation for the lymph nodes because that's the safe approach. But and then combining this with adjuvant immunotherapy. So it's a specific regimen, but with SBRT to the primary in order to facilitate better intrathoracic local control. So we'll see how this study pans out. Now, in terms of another approach, so we've established single agent specific. Now, how about multiple agents? And then we've talked about these drugs before, ones that target CD73 and then others that rescue the NK cell exhaustion. And then the COAST study, we heard about NeoCOAST in the surgical series, but COAST is trying to assess the combination of multiple drugs in the adjuvant setting may have a better durability of outcome than even our Pacific regimens. And there's some promising data to suggest that may be true. So we'll just have to wait for the final results from these studies. How about Pacific 9, which is also looking at combining these studies. So patients with unresectable, no progression after definitive chemoradiation, and also are getting different combinations of these drugs. So there will be a number of these types of studies that are going to show more drugs on the adjuvant side and more drugs on the neoadjuvant side. So how about Pacific 8? So this was a TIGIT. So we, you know, regulator, we cannot give up on this class of molecules just because it may have not panned out in the stage 4 setting. There are a number of drugs that didn't pan out early, such as durvalumab in the stage 4 setting, that have certainly panned out in the stage 3 setting. Now we have more data about durvalumab and other combination drugs that do work in the stage 4 setting. So we're assessing this TIGIT regulator in combination with durvalumab following chemo radiotherapy, and we hope to get some positive results from this group as well.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.